This is All Things Considered. On WNYC, I'm Jamie Floyd. It's the 100th anniversary of a disaster few remember, the 1918 influenza epidemic. It was a storm of infection that circled the globe, killing at least 50 million people. In New York City, the virus claimed 33,000 lives in less than a year. WNYC's Jim O'Grady has the story of a city under siege.
August 12th. A Norwegian ocean liner steams into New York Harbor. Health inspectors board to find passengers and crew stricken with a strangely violent flu. Four people are dead. Dozens are sent to hospitals on shore. Then more of these contagion ships arrive, including a Navy training vessel. But there's something about it that doesn't make sense. Most of the ill are neither old nor very young. They're robust women and men in the prime of their lives. John Barry, author of The Great Influenza, says their symptoms included pain in the bones and blue skin from lack of oxygen.
But the really horrific symptoms were bleeding not only from your nose or mouth, but from your eyes and ears.
Unusually, this flu takes root in the body in two places: the upper respiratory system, which makes it catchable by cough and sneeze, and deep in the lungs, where it blackens and blooms. The stronger the victim's immune system, especially in those of young adults, the harder it attacks the virus. So the flu plus the body's overreaction combined to liquefy the lungs.
People were dying in less than 24 hours after the first symptoms sometimes.
The crisis lands on the desk of City Health Commissioner Royal Copeland, a man who looks the part. He wears three-piece suits and a brass watch on a chain. He has a degree in homeopathy from the University of Michigan, but he's not a doctor. His main qualification is knowing people in the democratic political machine.
New York City had been governed under a reform regime for a while, and it had developed probably the best public health department in the world. And then Tammany Hall came back into power.
If there's a shorthand for political patronage and business above all else, it's Tammany Hall. Royal Copeland was a Tammany man. John Barry is not a fan.
When you mix science and politics, you get politics.
Barry says Copeland should have declared an epidemic and immediately banned parades and closed public gathering spaces, even if it hurt the economy and crippled Tammany's cash flow. Instead, Copeland tells the public there's no cause for alarm.
Elsewhere in the country, cities were closing saloons, closing theaters, they were closing churches. Almost every city in the country closed schools.
The debate over Copeland and his strategy continues to this day. He does have his defenders, among them
Alan Kraut, professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C.
Kraut defends Copeland with a stunning fact. New York City's death rate from influenza was lowest among cities on the East Coast at 4.5 per thousand. Boston's was 6.5. Philadelphia's 7.3.
Things went rather well under the circumstances.
The circumstances were these. The port could not be closed because the U.S. military was using it to send soldiers to Europe and back. Side note, World War I was happening, a war that was putting troops and populations on the move around the world, and with them, the virus.
Epidemics are like wars. They're serious.
New York's population in 1918 is 5.5 million. Kraut says with that many people, you can't force every infected person into isolation and every exposed person into quarantine. So Copeland got pragmatic.
He tried to do what he could using volunteerism and trying to co-opt the members of the business community and the theater community.
Copeland made theaters screen films with health tips like swat that fly and wash those hands. He urged businesses to stagger their hours to cut crowding in the barely ventilated subway. And Kraut says Copeland took advantage of a historical oddity. Immigrants, for once, were not being scapegoated.
Because it was so widespread that it was very hard to make the argument that any one group was responsible for influenza.
Immigrant newspapers and clergy dispelled rumors about the Germans putting the virus in Bayer aspirin or releasing it from U-boats. And they said, listen, fellow immigrants, quit drinking from that communal cup at the local water pump. And for God's sake, stop smoking your friend's pipe.
My name is James Colgrove. I'm a professor of public health at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health.
I asked Colgrove, were New Yorkers really so disgusting that they had to be told to stop hocking phlegm on each other?
There were definitely different ideas about what was appropriate hygienic behavior. So it used to be sort of culturally acceptable that you would spit on the floor of a saloon.
That's because germ theory, which took hold in the late 1800s, was still trickling down to the masses.
Exactly, yeah. 1918, it was still a kind of a transitional moment.
Some New Yorkers were quarantined. We just don't know how many. If you lived in a private home or an apartment, health inspectors might knock, and if they found you infected, say, stay inside. Then they slapped a placard on your door.
Notice to milkman. This house is under quarantine. The milkman must not enter.
Alan Kraut says Copeland's hardest decision involved school kids.
There was a lot of sentiment in New York for closing the schools. Copeland refused to do that at the recommendation of a remarkable person named S. Josephine Baker.
Sarah Josephine Baker, the city's first head of the Department of Child Hygiene, best known for that time Typhoid Mary tried to stab her with a fork. True story.
What Baker said to Copeland was, in effect, what the hell good is it to close all these schools and have these kids running around the street when you have them here? They can be inspected every day and ones who fall sick removed from the student population.
Baker also reminded Copeland that schools give poor children things they might not have at home, an extra meal, clean running water, the care of nurses.
It was a very, very clever move, and Copeland responded positively to it.
Jessica Cole is a planner with the city's Department of Health and Hygiene. She says months before the deadly outbreak of 1918, a milder version of the flu passed through New York and infected Royal Copeland's son. The 8-year-old survived.
But that experience has really convinced him even more of the correctness of keeping the schools open where they had access to medical care and monitoring.
Cole adds that 100 years later, the debate about isolating masses of people during an outbreak has effectively been settled.
But we would never utilize quarantine for a flu now because that's just not a really good effective way to fight against the flu. With the exception of, you know, that one-off case that might come off of the cruise ship or something like that.
Cole says the city is constantly getting ready for the next pandemic.
Are we prepared? Yes, I would say we are.
Because there will be one. Jim O'Grady, WNYC News.
WNYC is collaborating with the Museum of the City of New York on stories about how contagious diseases have shaped New York. The museum's new exhibit, Germ City, opens tomorrow.